Böll Spotlight, a podcast from the Heinrich Böll Foundation. Industry 4.0, green or dirty? Today we want to speak about digitization of our economies and the impact on the society and environment, especially in Asia. In many Asian countries, we see both the big chances of digitization and the big risks. The Asian governments are often pushing digitization. They are pursuing a digital-first policy. And it is true, digitization can help to enable development. At the same time, we encounter in these countries the dark side of digitization, violations of human rights and big environmental problems caused by the extraction of resources we need to build our new digital world. My name is Vanessa Löwel and I am speaking today with Michael Reckert. He is a geographer and he works for the German NGO PowerShift. So Michael, could you explain shortly what is PowerShift doing?
I'm working at PowerShift as a coordinator of a German civil society network called AK Rohstoffe, a working group on raw materials. And PowerShift is working, building capacities, capacity building for NGOs, and we work on raw material issues, on trade issues, and on climate issues.
So the Industry 4.0 and the industrial internet create great growth opportunities. We will be able to produce more efficiently. Some even refer to digitization as a green economy that helps the industry to produce more resource efficient, to pollute less. Michael Reckert, what do you make out of these claims?
Well, you describe the shining part of this digitalization in the Industry 4.0. We are also looking at the dark part. So what does it mean for the energy consumption? What does it mean for the raw materials we need for all these technical devices?
You already named two of these topics, like the impact of digitization on our demand of electricity and the impact on our demand of resources. So first, when the industry is moving more and more bits instead of materials, doesn't that help us to save energy?
Well, it's not only bits, it's also a lot of material products. So we need technical devices, we need mobile phones, we need, especially in the industry, we have a lot of sensors, some machines are communicating with machines. I think the German government expects that 32 billion parts will communicate via the internet in 2020. So this is much more than, I think, the 3.5 billion people on the world communicating via the internet. So this needs a lot of more electricity. One example, Greenpeace did a research that streaming of a movie needs much more energy than producing a DVD, shipping it, and watching it at home because the server where the movie is hosted needs 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and 365 days minimum a year electricity.
So our future is still run by resources of the 19th, 20th century.
In the moment, yes, but also in the future when we have more renewables, for example, or 100% renewables as an aim, we still need this electricity, and the demand for electricity is, as far as I know, still increasing. We're not debating on a limited planet how to reduce our energy consumption, but with this Industry 4.0 and with the digitalization of everything, there will be another burden on producing more renewables or energy in total.
So far, the myth that digitization will save energy.
Maybe just add on that. I mean, if you look on the product level, that might be true. So a fridge or a TV, maybe a single TV needs less electricity compared to the TV or to the fridge 20 years ago. But we are buying now bigger fridges, we are buying bigger TVs, we're buying more TVs, and this also adds to the energy consumption. I think it's the so-called rebound effect that we can also observe in the energy sector.
So then I have a personal question. My mother, for example, has a TV that is 20 years old, and she always said, no, I don't want to buy a new one because I want to save energy, I want to save resources. And my father says, no, we will save more, we will do better things for the world if we buy a new one. What is true?
I think both, because I suppose the old TV needs more energy.
So yes,
your parents could save energy. On the same time, if they buy a new TV, I mean, this has to be produced or is produced. So this needs new raw materials. So you're saving on the one side, but you're having a new demand on another side.
That leads me to the second question. So what about our demand of resources. With digitization, we already said it, a dematerialization of the industrial production. Doesn't that mean a reduction of resources? And doesn't that mean that we need less resources to keep our industry running?
I think there's a shift in the streams of the raw materials. Let's have two examples. One example is the car. Everyone is nowadays talking about electromobility. If we stop using oil and gas for fueling the cars, we need batteries. So we stop using oil and gas, where a lot of conflicts were when we extract that. And also with the pollution issues, the CO2 emissions, etc. On the other hand, we need raw materials like lithium, cobalt, etc., where there are new conflicts. This is one example. So this is change of the stream of raw materials. The second one is the dematerialization is often referred. We know research by the Deutsche Telekom, a telecommunication company in Germany. And they say, well, if we use in the near future all e-readers, we stop using magazines, we don't have to print books anymore, so we save materials, but they save paper, and paper made out of wood could be more or less, I mean, there's also a lot of criticism on that, but it could be renewable. The e-reader has totally different materials. It is metals, minerals, etc. So this is not renewable. You can extract them once. If you do it good, you can recycle parts, but in the moment it's quite hard to recycle because no one knows what's inside this e-readers, and it's very often in so limited amounts that it's not worth to recycle it. So we are losing metals and minerals, and we are losing this metals and minerals via the e-readers that help us to dematerialize our life.
That is what you show in your recent study, that there is a direct link between digitization and the growing consumption of resources in the world.
Well, the study in English is called The Dark Side of Digitalization, and you can find it on the PowerShift website, on the English website. In Germany, it's called Ressourcenfluch 4.0, and we are focusing there on the metals and minerals demand. So we took a research by the German government, and they had an analysis of 42 future technologies. And for all these technologies, you need a lot of sensors, RFID tags. And to build this RFID tags, the sensors, you need tin, you need copper, you need nickel, you need raw materials like gallium, tantal. Some of you maybe never have heard about it before. And so the German study says that with these 42 future technologies, we need four times the lithium in 2035 than produced in 2013. So we need much more lithium, we need much more rare earth elements, we need much more tantal and tin. Both are so-called conflict minerals. We need much more copper in the near future. The demand will increase dramatically.
Let's take a look at Asian countries. Especially Asian countries are pushing hard for digital transformation. Countries like China or India adopted political strategies like Made in China 2025 or Digital India. So these countries pursue a digital first policy. So how do Asian countries work on topics like Industry 4.0 or the Internet of Things?
Well, as far as I know, and I'm not very deep into the strategies, but as far as I know, they're doing the same like Germany, US, France, or the UK, so there's no difference. So the interesting thing is, and that's the same all over the world, it's a debate among the elites, the politicians, and the business sector. It's not about the indigenous people's communities living where the raw materials are could be found.
Which resources are extracted in Asian countries, for example?
For example, China is the fourth biggest lithium producer. We always forgot if we only look into Latin America and the issues. Graphite, for example, is also mined in China and also in North Korea. There are several countries producing nickel, like Philippines, Indonesia. Tin is in China. I think China, Indonesia, and Myanmar are the three most supplier for the world. And also the rare earth elements, which is quite famous because China is in the moment producing more than 90%. And the rare earth elements are quite crucial for a lot of technical devices.
So that puts China in a powerful position.
China has a very powerful position because they can mine the resources in their country. They are producing these raw materials, so that means smelting or refining it, so buying it from several other countries. And they're doing the next steps in the value chain. So they're also producing the IT technology, etc. So China is really one of the crucial players.
I want to come back to the impact of this extraction of resources. What about the consequences on the environment, the environmental impact in these countries?
Sadly, there's a long tradition. I mean, mining and extraction of raw materials is one of the oldest businesses in the world.
And it didn't become cleaner. Nothing changed?
Well, it didn't change much, sadly. So giving you an example, we had this year a guest from the Philippines, Dr. Benito Molino. He's coming from the northwest of Philippines, a province called Zambales. They are very rich in nickel. I visited him in 2015, and he showed this year pictures in 2017. And he showed how the nickel companies don't care that the nickel is washed away in the rivers. So the rivers are red, reddish. They poison rice fields. They poison fruit trees. They poison fish ponds. And in 2015, we spoke with fishermen, and they said, we have to go far away to the ocean, and we don't catch so much fish that we can have three meals a day. So it's really a violation of the right to food. In Myanmar, we know that the extraction of some raw materials also fuel the conflicts in the border regions. So we have this conflict minerals in Myanmar. We have this huge conflict about the smelter of rare earths in Malaysia, which is quite interesting because German companies announced very early that they want to buy from this rare earths smelter and step back later.
So could you please tell me, what is happening there in Malaysia?
The rare earth there is mined in Australia, and the Australian company Lynas is shipping it to Malaysia and smelting it there and refine it there.
Why not in Australia?
Because the ecological standards are lower. So if you get this rare earth out of the soil, there are radioactive materials, and these radioactive materials have to be stored somewhere. And the standard is much higher in Australia. So they went to Malaysia. And the interesting thing is that the people in Malaysia started to demonstrate against this refiner, and they built the biggest eco-movement in the history of the country. They had some wins and some losses. In the end, Lynas, that's the company, is producing the rare earths there, but not on that level as they planned to. And they got a lot of attention. So Lynas is really, really struggling, because also some investors went back, some buyers backed out, etc.
I would love to know, what about the people living near or working in these mines and refineries? So under which conditions are these resources extracted in Asia?
It really, really, really depends on the country, and I think also on the mine. I think there are some bigger mines nearly fully automated, so there is not much work, especially not for untrained people living in the area before, which is already one of the big conflicts. The people expect getting jobs, and they're only getting a big mine in front of their door. Then there are smaller mines, there's small-scale mining. Some small-scale mines have nearly no standards, so it's really hard hand work. So some of the tunnels are dangerous. It depends. There are gold mines in the Philippines where children are working. There are mines in Myanmar which are controlled more or less from the army or from rebels. So we don't know how the conditions are there. We know there are issues about West Papua in Indonesia where no activist and no journalist is allowed to go. So we can guess that the standard is not the best and not the highest, because in general it's the local people, journalists, and civil society organizations that find out corruption, human rights violation, environmental degradation, etc. A lot of activists, also environmental activists, are killed. There's a Global Witness report that last year in 2016, 200 people were killed because of their human rights activities. And I think the Philippines are ranked third or fourth in this statistics. So we see that indigenous people's rights are violated very often. So their right to free, prior informed consent to give the land title to the mining company. So very often the local community is not benefiting from the mine, because the money is going to the international company and to some tax havens, and also to the government in the capital region. So the local communities very often burden all this negative aspects and don't even get jobs.
We saw in Malaysia this example of protests of the civil society.
I think civil society plays really a crucial role. The issue is very often these protests are local organized, so they don't get an echo on the national level, and especially not on the international level, because a lot of companies are transnational companies, or they are selling to a market which is transnational organized.
So we just saw how the civil society in Asia deals with these issues. But what about the governments?
In the 1990s, we see worldwide that with the adjustment programs of the World Bank and the IMF, that a lot of laws changed, a lot of mining laws. The ideology behind that is that you own something and you have debts because of your social programs or whatever, and you sell your raw materials to the market, gets money, and can do social welfare, education stuff, etc. Sadly, that only worked in theory, but that meant that a lot of countries changed their mining laws. Very friendly to investors, very unfriendly to the local people.
Let's come back to the global perspective, to the international perspective. In your report, you criticize that many governments pursue wrong resource policies. What kind of political measures do we need to enable that digital transformation can indeed be a contribution to a more sustainable economy?
I think the important change is made in the countries who demand for these raw materials. And this means especially Germany, the EU, US. We need binding laws, and we have already some international standards like the UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights. We have several OECD standards that explain what should companies do. And we have to make this binding laws and for everyone, and also for companies that are selling electronic products produced in China. They have to make sure that then these Chinese or wherever these companies come from, make sure that they don't violate human rights.
In your report, you're aiming as well at the recycling aspect.
For example, we need mobile phones or televisions that could be paired again. This is where we have to put much more thoughts into. For example, to have product design that enables companies to recycle.
So may I ask, what kind of smartphone do you have?
I have a very, very unfair old Nokia, which is now, I think, more than 7 years old. It's still a cell phone and not a smartphone. The struggle is, we know a lot of electronics and the production standards and all the human rights violations if it comes to the raw materials, but there's nearly no product that is 100% fair. Don't think with the huge amount of raw materials we consume that the consumption issue is the one we can solve it, sadly.
That means we need to buy less.
I know this is not a very popular message, but there is nothing like fair consumption, which is a really, really, really problem. So yeah, we need to use our things longer. We have to buy things where the software is working longer than the 2 years. We have to minimize our footprint on all scales. But also, I think that the main issue is not on a personal level, but on a political level.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Böll Spotlight, a podcast from the Heinrich Böll Foundation.